From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Split show tonight. Later on, UFOs and covert programs. But we're going to be talking about some UFO mysteries in a moment as well, so stand by for that. Well, if you're tired of hearing about guns, I've got to talk about this for a moment. President Barack Obama's sweeping plan to address gun violence was met with very swift and stiff resistance by gun rights advocates and conservative lawmakers, setting up a very tense debate that will be held on the airwaves, in congressional hearing rooms, and in communities all across America. The package proposed Wednesday is the most comprehensive in decades. The president called for a new, tougher assault weapons ban and a 10-round limit on magazines, as well as legislation to bar the possession of armor-piercing bullets and require criminal background checks for nearly all gun sales. Separately, he approved 23 executive actions calling for additional funding to address mental health and school security. The movement comes in the wake of last month's school massacre in Connecticut, where 20 children and 6 adults were killed. John Lott, been on the program many times, More Guns, Less Crime, author and researcher. He's with us. John, first of all, would you put this entire proposal that occurred today in perspective? What does it all mean?
Well, it means a lot more regulation of people's lives. I'm most concerned that it's going to mean law-abiding citizens are going to find it more difficult in many ways to be able to go and get guns. And I think it's either going to have no effect in some places on crime rates or, unfortunately, have perverse effects. I'd like to believe that the president hasn't thought out this stuff, but there's so much of a discussion of only the benefits of the regulations, and he really hasn't thought through, I think, the costs of many of them.
And I was going to say, John, of the proposals, are there some that have some teeth? Are there some issues there that you say, even you, a very staunch gun advocate, would say, all right, maybe we need this? Anything there?
I mean, you look at it, he wants to essentially renew the assault weapons ban and the magazine sizes, but we've had that before. And there's been a lot of research. I don't know anybody that's shown a benefit from that. And then you look at some of these other things, like this universal background checks. I don't really think he's thought through the cost there. I'd like to believe, I mean, we'd all like to have some type of magic bullet there that would work, but I just don't think we're going to see a benefit there. I think there's, he doesn't address the long delays that many people have for background checks already that makes it so that people who need to get a gun quickly for self-defense are going to find themselves thwarted in that. And, I don't know. I mean, some of these other things, making the CDC go and do research, I don't really see. I mean, we have a lot of research anyway. He makes it sound as if the government doesn't go and do the research itself, researchers in academia aren't going to have an incentive to go and do it on their own.
Well, it's an issue, John, that's, of course, split right down the middle in this country again, where you've got gun advocates and people who think that the Second Amendment is truly under attack. And then we have a lot of people who want gun control. You know, there's that camp out there that wants this. I think the concern that I have over this entire issue is it continues to divide a nation that doesn't need that right now.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things that disturbed me in his talk was a couple times he is unwilling to believe that people on the other side are well-motivated. You know, he talked about how people opposed his efforts because they were essentially making money by selling weapons that were involved in killing people. That somehow people on the other side, want to have more deaths because that means that they can make more money. I don't know about you. I mean, I think you and I agree on a lot of these things. I don't think that it classifies either myself or your views on this. That we do this, we talk about these issues because we do care about safety. We just disagree with the president in many ways on what would accomplish that. And I just wish he'd feel that all of us are motivated by the same same goals, even if we have different and we differ in terms of what we think works.
And Sean, not many people are talking about the fact that nearly every one of these shooters over the past several years has been under some kind of pharmaceutical prescription drugs for some kind of mental illness.
Right.
Nobody's talking about that. And I think that these psychotic drugs that they're taking are playing a huge role in what they're doing.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess it depends how you define mental illness, obviously. But you have these people committing suicide. It indicates a level of depression to begin with. I mean, these people go and try to commit suicide in a way that's going to get them attention.
Yeah.
You know, so they
These are murderers, John, who go in, kill and maim innocent people, and then they kill themselves. And, and that's their plan from the get-go, isn't it?
I couldn't agree more. 75% of the time where these crimes occur, the killers die at the scene. And even in the 25% where they don't die, when people have talked to them afterwards, they planned on killing themselves, but at the last moment, they just couldn't bring themselves to pull the trigger to die. And unless you kind of deal with that fact, that what motivates these guys and why they do it, you know, there's two ways, I think, to deal with it. One is to take away their gain by not giving them the publicity, and that's not going to happen. And, you know, we're not going to get rid of the First Amendment, and I'm not advocating that we would, but at least to understand in the back of people's minds what's going on there. And the second thing is to try to limit their carnage. And the best way you do that is by quickly getting a gun to the scene. The faster you can get there, somebody to stop, the more you're going to reduce the harm that they can get and take away some of the gain in their warped mind from going and committing these crimes.
That's exactly right. We are not going to stop a sicko from doing what they want to do. This is going to happen again. The question is, will anybody be there, have a concealed weapon, will have some kind of defense where they can take this person out before he kills more people? And that's what it comes down to. John, thanks so much for being on the program. And of course, everybody, you're going to hear more and more about this. It's all over the place. It's not going to go away. The New York Police Department, by the way, wants pharmacies in and around the city to fight prescription drug thefts by stocking pill bottles fitted with GPS tracking chips. The New York Police Department believes that the so-called bait bottles would help investigators track stolen drugs and locate suspects. In Florida, a Florida Senate panel says police should be banned from using drones to spy on citizens there. A bill that would prohibit law enforcement agencies from gathering evidence or other information flew through the Criminal Justice Committee with a unanimous vote. It also would ban government agencies from using drones for code enforcement as well. Our privacy expert, Catherine Albrecht, with us. Catherine, sounds like a good plan. Somebody in the Senate's thinking out there.
Well, thank goodness. I'm glad somebody in Florida has a clue. And, you know, this is the place where we're seeing good movement on the privacy front is on the state and local levels. We're not seeing it on the federal level, that's for sure. But let me tie these two stories in for you, George, the two that you just mentioned. The one about New York wanting to put these tracking devices into pill bottles. The idea is not that every single pill bottle would be trackable, but that they would put a certain number of these devices in there, almost like, you know, they put the exploding glue,
ink packages and
yeah,
money.
Like into the dollars that they, the packages of money that they put into the getaway, you know, sack as they're filling it up with money at the bank. It's kind of the same idea that these things would be trackable, but I want to tie this in with something I talked about on Costa not too long ago, which is the spray-on RFID antennas. There is a new technology, nanotechnology, where you can take paint, you can spray it onto a tree, and you can create an antenna that can pick up an RFID signal and beam an RFID signal from something like a medicine bottle up to an airplane. And this is where I think the drones are so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The FAA has told us we could see as many as 30,000 of these drones in U.S. skies within the next couple of years. And the drones up in the sky are powerful enough. These are unmanned airplanes, kind of like your kid would fly a little airplane with a joystick, doing the same thing. These things can read a milk carton from 60,000 feet up in the air. They can scan an entire city with one little camera. They are incredibly powerful. They can crack into the Wi-Fi networks. They can have facial recognition on board that could identify anybody on the ground. And if they create this RFID network, the drones could literally fly overhead and figure out if you had one of these medicine bottles in your house. I mean, it's mind-blowing.
It is amazing.
So the state of Florida is on the right track. They're saying, no, I don't care what Janet Napolitano wants to do with this stuff or what Homeland Security is saying. At least in the state of Florida, if this bill passes, and I sure hope it does, it would prohibit law enforcement agencies from gathering evidence with these things by going on just fishing expeditions over people's homes. And it would say, hey, you're going to have a signed warrant from a judge, just like any other technology.
I love it. Catherine, thanks. Thanks so much. The guests that appear on our little news segments, you can follow their websites on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Nebraska Governor David Heineman became the second Republican governor in the last week to propose ending his state's income tax, saying that he wants to make Nebraska more competitive with its neighbors by eliminating the tax on both individuals and corporations. He says that if a complete elimination of the two taxes is not passed, he would push to lower taxes as well. Last week, a Louisiana governor said he wanted to eliminate all personal and corporate income taxes in the state there. Something strange going on in South Carolina. Right off the coast there, thousands of dead fish washed up on the beach. They're not sure why. The U.S. and Europe have cemented their plan to work together on the American's next generation capsule to take humans beyond Earth. The Orion vehicle is being built to carry astronauts to the moon, asteroids, Mars, but it will need a means to propel itself through space. That's where Europe comes in. They have formally agreed to provide that technology. Light passing through the body into the womb has an important role in the developing eye, according to the researchers. A study published in the journal Nature showed that mice spending pregnancy in complete darkness had babies with altered eye development. Up next, Timothy Green Beckley joins us. We're going to be talking about his work in the field of UFOs. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Well, they call him Mr. UFO. He's an author, publisher, producer, paranormal investigator. Tim Beckley's been on the program with me, has traveled the world in search of the unexplained. Now, he has told about his encounter with a man in black and UFO hunters and recently tried to convince William Shatner that a very small figure, said by some to be an alien, was in actuality a member of the mythical Jinn family. That's what they talk about in the Middle East. Tim has lived in a haunted house and experienced a number of UFO sightings. He was a little guy when that happened. Tim, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, George. Good evening. Happy to be back on Coast and share what knowledge I have with the listeners out there.
Lots of strange UFO reports lately. Michigan, for example. San Antonio.
I was going to mention that. Of course, you know, a lot of people poo-poo or make fun of the videos that are posted on, like, YouTube and these other sites saying, well, they're hoaxes or they're done in Photoshop and so forth. But I saw one. Now, did you see the ones that were taken near Detroit recently?
Oh, I did. I had them on our website yesterday.
Okay. Well, now, that's not fake. I mean, come on. All right, one person can make, a bogus UFO video and post it, especially of lights in the sky. But there were multiple witnesses to this, they keep coming at a steady pace. Now, I was on a show recently, and one of the hosts said, well, all these people have cell phones out there, and they've got tablets, and they've got all kinds of recording equipment, and nobody's getting any really good UFO photos. Well, I think, George, to be honest with you, I think the quality of the photographic equipment has gone downhill. It hasn't gotten any better.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever tried taking a photograph of an object at night with your cell phone? I mean,
it doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
It's dark.
In fact, even a normal camera, and I've fooled around with the photography. I mean, I consider myself kind of a semi-professional photographer in that I've sold photos, but I wouldn't consider them the best necessarily in the world. But it's very difficult to take a photograph of something at a distance. I'm near the Empire State Building here, and you know, I it's remarkable to me. I go out there at night, and people are standing three blocks away with their little cameras, taking flash shots of the Empire State Building. Well, they're not going to come out.
No.
And if you even take a, try to take a photograph of the moon, it's not happening. I mean, it's a, it'll appear as a little dot in the sky. So when somebody gets something that that looks halfway decent, they're to be commended for it. And I think the ones over that area of Detroit there look really good. I mean, there could be something else, but the fact that they make no noise and there are multiple witnesses. Now, did you catch, did anybody say how big they thought this object was?
They were huge. Now, you know, I couldn't say they were a mile wide, yeah, like some people have reported on, like, the Phoenix Lights.
Well, episodes. That's right. Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
But these were big, triangular-shaped objects, and you could clearly see the light pattern underneath it as if they were at each point of the triangle.
Right. Well, now, in you know, people say, well, these are secret government tests or something. Well,
maybe.
Well, come on, George. By this time, they would have tested it how many times? I mean, it's just, you know.
I know.
The sightings go on and on. And what are they doing with these objects if they're testing them? I mean, they must have an ultimate purpose. Are they more snooping devices on us? I mean, you know, like, what's the purpose here? No, I think these things are a part of a random pattern of events that have been taking place for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And somehow I got scooped up into this at an early age, and it continues to, you know, to follow me throughout my life. Now, I'm one of the few people who've actually managed to come out ahead on this, or at least to some degree, because I do run a publishing empire, and I say that facetiously, of course, because what kind of empire could you say? You know, selling UFO books, but I enjoy doing it. And now what we're doing, a lot of the books, you know, that were done in the early 50s and so forth have fallen into public domain. So we've taken these books, we've put new covers on them, we've reset the type, and we've had modern-day researchers like Nick Redford and myself and Tim Schwartz, Sean Castile, add up-to-date material.
Great.
That verifies what was written 35, 40 years ago, and we're offering this material to a whole new generation of researchers and people who are interested in the topic. So this has been my work now for the last couple of years, and we've got something like 259 titles, I think, up on Amazon. You know, so
that's
we
great.
Keep doing it, and some of the books sell fairly decently, and some books hardly sell at all, to be honest with you. You know, we've got a couple of titles that just kind of hang there, and we wonder why somebody doesn't order them once in a while. But that's probably would be with any publisher, I bet. You know, in fact, I know it's a fact, and most of the big ones have disappeared, and we still keep going because basically it's a one-man operation here. It's me and a computer and two great people who help us do the graphics and set the type and upload it and do all the stuff that I have no technical knowledge of whatsoever.
Well, Tim, have you found that those old books of the past by the people like Frank Edwards and mm-hmm. those people sold more in those days in that era? Was there more of an interest in UFOs back in the 50s?
Yes, I would say that probably is the case. Now, of course, every once in a while a hot title will come along, like a Communion probably might have been the last really really
Whitley's book,
big seller,
yeah.
And Phil Corso's book, I believe,
Day After Roswell,
was on the bestseller list, briefly at least. But I would say, well, it was a novelty then. You know, back in the late 1940s and 1950s. We had just started our own interest in going into outer space. And I think this was all kind of wrapped up into that. And in fact, if nothing else, flying saucers makes us think. It expands our imagination. And I think actually it's kind of discouraging to see the scientific community and men of letters and academia, as well as the government, poo-poo this, because I think that there is stuff that we could learn, from it. Not only on a physical, reality level, but there could be something here that these craft or these beings that are operating intelligence, I call it Power X myself, may have a message for us, and,
sure.
and we're blocking it out. It's like almost anything today, like you were saying. You know, it's like if you don't. if you don't accept an idea, the guy next door should accept exactly what you believe or shouldn't, you know, think on his own. And that's kind of the situation with this, you know, like just because the government doesn't believe in UFOs, I don't see any reason why the average guy in the street or a person has an interest in this, they can't go it on their own. And I, you know, it's kind of funny because I guess the polls show that there's a great deal of interest in this and 30%.
Well, yeah, they all still believe it. Tim, we're going to talk about abductions when we come back. Welcome back to Coast with author Timothy Green Beckley, of course. His website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Tim, what's your take? What's your view on the abduction phenomena?
Well, you know, George, I haven't really studied, you know, I've met all the, I guess, key players. You know, I knew Betty Hill and Peter Robbins. You've had him on the show, of course.
Yes.
His sister was a fairly good friend of mine, Helen Wheels. She was the punk rock performer. And both Peter and her had a sighting back when they were very young, I think about 12 or 13 or around then. And Helen claims that she was actually taken inside the craft. And I have no reason to doubt her, you know, story. Now, I am kind of somewhat leery about all these hypnotic, these cases where people are hypnotized and they are, they bring out additional details. Because, you know, if you have an experience, let's say you think that you've been abducted or you know you've been abducted, and somebody puts you under a hypnosis, I mean, you're going to expand on what happened to you, see? So how do you tell what really happened and what didn't happen? I mean, it's just kind of, to me, it's a toss-up and it's a very tricky question. Now, of course, the late Bud Hopkins, one of the best cases he was involved in, is this gal that lives down in the lower Manhattan, Linda Quartilia,
right,
who apparently was taken out of her bedroom the window and
floated up, right?
Floated up into the ship. Now, I've met her over the years. In fact, when I was doing UFO conferences out there in California and in Arizona, she came and spoke for us and had a workshop. And I have no doubt that she's very sincere about this. And supposedly other people did witness it, witness her floating up into the this shaped craft. It's a phenomenal story. It's hard to take at face value. My own interest in this, I guess, to some degree, since I started out in the 1950s, you know, I had my first of three major sightings when I was 10 years old in 1957. And that was the, I guess, the hottest era for UFOs, 1952, 1957, there was a big, you know, flap, and then not till 1965 when things heated up, and that was over in Ann Arbor.
That's right.
You know, so,
mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know, because so the abduction thing just hasn't, it hasn't been my bailiwick, and I've been more interested in the contactee experiences. I knew most of the people, like Howard Menger, and I've met the members of George Van Tassel's family.
How about Adamski? Was he before your time?
No, I never met Adamski. But interestingly enough, there was a fellow that I worked with for many, many years out of Washington, D.C. He's deceased now. His name was Harold Sulkin. And Harold and Clara John was his partner. And she was the ghostwriter of Inside the Spaceship. In fact, Adamski never really wrote any of the books per se. I mean, he wasn't a great writer, so just like many other people who are authors, you get somebody who can put your words down on paper. Anyway, Harold knew Adamski fairly well. He and many of the other contactees stayed at their house there near DuPont Circle. And he had mixed feelings about Adamski. He believed his original encounter in the desert there, where he claims he met this tall, a blonde-haired Venusian stepping out of a ship and telepathically mm-hmm. communicating with him. But he did feel that a lot of the photographs and the video of the motion picture, I guess they were shot in 8mm or 16mm in those days, were fabricated. And, of course, Jim Moseley, who just passed away here, and he was a buddy of mine for many, many years, he was not a big believer in Adamski. I myself think that some of his earlier incidents had some validity to it, but A lot of these guys, frankly, they like the attention, and they wanted to keep going on Long John Show and all these other programs and lecturing around the country. So in order to keep the people coming back, I think they added a little bit of the, you know.
The mystique.
Increased the size of the pie. Now, Adamski did a book, I think it was around 1949. This is 3 or 4 years before he wrote Flying Saucers Have Landed with Desmond Leslie. It's called Pioneers from Space. We have bought it out in a sparkling new edition. Now, we found out by doing research that Adamski's interest in New Age and metaphysical subjects actually went back to the 1930s. Adamski claimed that he spent his youth in Tibet. Well, we know that wasn't true.
So he made that up.
Well, apparently he did, but he ran an organization. He had a cultural center there. Where he had like miniature pyramids and people that, you know, dressing up as Egyptians. And this was around 1937. How we knew this is that the Los Angeles Times did a big article on Adamski in that period. So he was involved in all this mysticism many, many years before he claimed that he had, encountered the solution in the desert. And also, most people do not realize, and his followers, his closely knit followers, like to play this down, because he told everybody that these were physical experiences, that there was no psychism involved in this. When he said he went inside a ship and he went into outer space, he went in the physical body. This was no hanky-panky. This was no astral projection. Yet, his first experience, the one in the, I think it was outside a desert city, where 8 people supposedly witnessed the landing or coming down very close to the ground and the Venusian Orthon coming out. Actually, they were told to go to this specific area by using the Ouija board. Now, if that isn't psychism, I don't know what is. And how I know this? Well, we've recently published some books by a gentleman who was very close to Adamski in the late 40s and early 50s, a gentleman by the name of George Hunt Williamson. And he was one of the witnesses, along with his wife, who say that they actually saw Adamski meeting this being, and they took a plaster of Paris of the boots that were left, the imprints that were left in the ground and everything, and they had some strange symbols and everything on it and so forth. But if it hadn't been for a Ouija board session, apparently that contact, if indeed it did take place, would never have occurred, or they would have never been sent to that particular area.
Well, Tim, let me ask you this about biblical visitations. You know, they talk about in Genesis fallen angels. They talk about the Nephilim coming down here. Do you think that they were explaining extraterrestrial visitations? They just didn't know it, so they called them gods?
Well, I don't like to call them extraterrestrials. I refer to them as ultra-terrestrials because we really don't know where they come from. I mean, we have no proof that really that they come from outer space. They seem to be more part of our everyday environment. I mean, who's to say that they don't have they don't reside right here on Earth? Some of them seem to be invisible. They seem to come from another dimension. Some of them could actually be time travelers. So I don't know what the proof is actually that these are visitors from outer space. They don't behave like visitors from another planet should.
How so?
And, now, if you ask me about the biblical occurrences and things that are written in the Bible, I have to admit I'm a little skeptical. First of all, we weren't there when it happened. And the Bible has been interpreted and translated and the books left out of it and so forth. So, to me, it's a mystical book indeed. But how much of it, really tells the story of what happened in those days? Hard for me to say. I'm not convinced. I'm a spiritual person, but I'm not a Bible thumper.
Okay. Now, let's look at why you think we're being visited in whatever form or fashion, whether they're here, coming from a hollow Earth, other dimensions, other planetary systems. What's so special about good old planet Earth?
Well, this would indicate to me that they call this their home, or they are closely akin to our planet. Because you're right, what exactly is so special about it? Now, I guess Zacharias Stichen and all talks about the Anunnaki and the fact that they were coming down here to mine gold. I don't know. What makes us think that gold would have any relevance or any value to someone else on some other...
Well, they needed it for their atmosphere. Of course, I don't know what it would do.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's like a shield.
There's overwhelming evidence that obviously people have seen and experienced a bewildering assortment of bewildering events. I mean, you've got some good, hard, solid cases like pilots, and these are the ones that people like Stanton Friedman like to, you know, point to, because they are of the opinion that these are interplanetary visitors. But are they coming here on a daily basis, and are they coming in thousands of different ships that are all different shapes and sizes and doing all different sorts of things, and the beings never quite look the same? Now, I'd like to go back. I've been doing this for 40-something years, and I'm not quite as active today as a field investigator as I was in the old days. You know, back in the 60s and 70s, I was about the only one actually traveling the country, and in those days, we had local TV shows. I remember doing, like, Good Morning Tidewater.
Good Morning almost every station had its own little local show.
Now, they weren't necessarily timed very well. I guess it was a regulation that you had to have so much local programming. I don't know if that rule still applies or not, but the station managers, or I guess the owners, always picked the most awkward times to put on the local programming, like Sunday morning at 6 a.m.
Yeah.
Is that true, George?
That's right.
Am I right? Awkward hours, you would have these local programs on. I remember going to Tidewater, that would be like Virginia Beach, and I thought I would be the only guest for a half an hour, and I was upstaged by a local clown. But I got my message across, whatever the message was. You know, in those days, I had my handful of slides, and we would take those around and show them, and it went over very well. But, you know, people always say, well, why do you want people to believe in UFOs? Well, I never really was out there. I'm not an evangelist, per se, on this. I have some interesting stories, I think, to relate, and I've found it fascinating myself, and I've had, quite a few unusual experiences, not only of UFO sightings, but of some psychic things, and a whole bunch of synchronicities. I think that there's some super intelligence here, and I call it Power X, for lack of a better name, or Alta Terrestrials. And I think they're trying to, they could be doing two things. They could either be pushing us along, or they could be tricking us.
Or maybe
they're doing a combination of all of these things. Because you can't really put your finger on. People say, well, what is this intelligence? And I can't tell you. All I know is that if you study the body of literature and you talk to people who have had UFO experiences, and I've done this. In fact, sometimes I've gone back 3 or 4 or 5 years later. And in some cases, actually, I've even had the close friendships with some of these people where I just started out with my interviewing them. And years later, it turned out that not only were they did it start with a UFO sighting or a close encounter, but they were being overwhelmed by a poltergeist phenomenon in their house, objects, disappearing and reappearing again. So there's more to it than just those physical ships in the sky. There's something very weird about all of this, and I think we spent way too much time trying to prove that these are, you know, interplanetary visitors. And that's why I don't think personally that disclosure is going to work.
I don't think so either. But it is romantic, though, Tim, to think of life out there on other planets.
Oh my God! Yes, of course. And I don't doubt that there is life there on other planets, but. Why are they visiting us? Why are they hovering over Detroit in
a depressed city?
in
my old hometown.
In cigar-shaped crafts and in disc-shaped crafts and UFOs that look like tops, and I guess in the triangulars and boomerangs, and they certainly all have different models. And where do they go to? You know, it's like if you're seen over Detroit, you got to pass over Cleveland on the way, or Chicago, or somewhere, and they magically disappear.
Yeah.
And so you can draw two conclusions here. It's an illusion, and some people believe that it's part of some Project Bluebeam, but I don't buy that at all, because Project Bluebeam would not have gone back hundreds of years ago, and we've got sightings going back to even the time of Christopher Columbus. You know, he was coming over and near in the Bermuda Triangle, actually, and here comes an object out of the sky, and it lands in the ocean, and we know that these USOs, undersea objects, have been seen frequently. You know, these things are going into the earth, they're going into bodies of water, and they're disappearing in front of our eyes. It doesn't sound like spaceships to me, and it doesn't sound like Gordon Cooper.
No, but that was a great story, too, in his day. Former astronaut, you know, Gordon Cooper.
Well, you know, actually, this is very interesting. I spoke to Gordon Cooper. He actually called me on the telephone, and I'll tell you why. I was on a radio station in Florida, and we got talking about, I had written a book, which is still in print, MJ-12 and the Riddle of Hangar 18.
Yeah, good job, by the way.
Yeah, I'm not so interested in the MJ-12 papers anymore, because I think that most of them could be made up. But I was always fascinated with Len Stringfield's work on the crashed UFOs. I mean, I've heard stories about crashed UFOs, that objects that were shot at and landed in Central Park. I mean, everybody's got a crashed UFO story. So Gordon Cooper had been on the Merv Griffin show, and somehow the conversation got around to alien bodies. And basically he said that he had heard rumors of, autopsies being performed and, people seeing these deceased.
Was he talking about Roswell?
Well, I thought maybe he had spoken to Jackie Gleason, but it could have been Roswell.
Gleason apparently saw some bodies at Homestead Air Force Base.
Absolutely, I know the story, because Jackie Gleason and I had a brief correspondence. He was a regular guest, on the Long John show.
Devil show, sure.
Yes, and he had probably the world's largest paranormal
library.
Which is in the University of Florida, Miami, or wherever. And a couple of my books are in there, because he ordered them from me. And, in fact, I was very impressed as a youth. I think the first book I ever mimeographed was something called UFOs Around the World. We actually had collected articles from different international researchers, which nobody was doing at that time, except for maybe the APRO organization. And he ordered a copy of the book. I don't know, you said it's $4.95 in the mail or something like that. And the person was stationary, and I zipped it off to him. And somebody had called me a couple of years ago and apparently was researching a book on there, doing something on Jackie Gleason. And I said, oh, he ordered a copy of the book. And the woman said, oh, that's why I'm calling you, because I saw it in the library. So it's still
there.
That's
cool. It's still there.
And of course, he had a home in upstate New York that was shaped like a landed flying saucer.
That's right.
Anyway, he met Larry Warren, who, of course, was the co-author of the book with Peter Robbins about the left at Eastgate, the Bentwaters, case there in England. Of course, it's very famous, and to me, it's one of the most documented UFO incidents of...
Hold on for a second, Tim. I want to talk more about this with you when we come back. Let's get into the Gordon Cooper story, and we'll take phone calls from people who have questions about UFOs. Timothy Green Beckley, our special guest right here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back with your calls. Don't touch your dial.